ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making its One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Do to a dog what we do to factory farmed animals and you'd be arrested. But do it to 10,000 pigs in a shed? Well, then you can feed a city. Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National and across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. It's the panel show about the things we believe, and most of us believe, cruelty to animals is wrong. But just why we believe it, well, that question is more interesting than you might think. My two guests today think the way we treat animals is a moral catastrophe. They reach the same destination, but the way they get there is very different. And they really need no introduction, but introduce them I will. Peter Singer is considered the world's most influential living philosopher. He's with us in our Melbourne studios. Now, it was 50 years ago that he wrote Animal Liberation. That's the book that is considered widely to have launched the modern animal liberation movement. His podcast, Lives Well Lived. And we have the company of David Clough. He's a professor of theology at University of Aberdeen. After his years of work at Cambridge and Oxford and Yale, he's the author of a two-volume epic simply entitled On Animals. It's considered to be the most comprehensive theological study of animal welfare in the Christian tradition, and that's saying something. Peter, let's start with you. Your case is simple, maybe radical. Animals matter because they can suffer, and ignoring this is like a kind of sexism or racism, in this case, speciesism.
That's right, and I use those parallels because most of the people that we speak to agree that to say that one person's suffering matters less because they're not a member of our race is a really bad thing to say. That's just not defensible. Or similarly, to say that a person's suffering matters less because we're male and they're female, also not a thing that anybody could defend. So why do we imagine that we could defend the idea that suffering matters less because the being is not a member of our species? Of course, species may make a difference to how much an animal suffers or what ways an animal can suffer, but if we are talking about similar quantities of suffering, I can't see any justification for thinking that the suffering of a being who is not a member of our species should matter less than the suffering of a being who is a member of our species.
Well, before we get to David, Peter, I must ask, octopuses suffer and they're smart and they make decisions by reason. Crabs can suffer, but they're dumb and they make decisions by instinct. Does that mean they're both, under your model, entitled to moral consideration?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm going to draw quite as sharp a distinction as you just did between octopuses and crabs. Of course, biologically, they're extremely different. But to say crabs are dumb, I think maybe goes a little too far. But certainly, they don't seem as good at problem solving as an octopus is, if that's what you mean. But yes, there's good reason to believe that they are capable of suffering. There was a report that came out of the London School of Economics, which said that the class of beings they belong to, decapod crustaceans, which includes lobsters as well, by the way, there is significant evidence that they are capable of suffering. So my answer is yes, their suffering matters. We don't know exactly what it's like. That's part of the problem of saying exactly when quantities of suffering are equal. But if we were to inflict what might be very severe suffering on a crab just because we like to eat the flesh of that crab when we could nourish ourselves perfectly well from other plant-based foods, that seems to me quite unjustified because we are just automatically assuming that the suffering of the crab isn't significant, doesn't really matter.
But it only comes down to the intelligence of the animal insofar as that intelligence informs the question, how much can they suffer?
That's right. Just as among humans too, we don't try to say, well, some people do really well on IQ tests and others don't, and so we don't have to take so much notice of the sufferings of the ones who don't do so well. That would be a horrible thing to say. And I think the same is true when we're comparing intelligence of beings who are capable of suffering.
Well, to David Clough, we know what suffering is that Peter speaks of because we suffer ourselves. Why is the foundation of your work something that we can't agree on, something upon which we're not certain?
So all ethics starts from somewhere. I'm a Christian, I'm a Christian theologian, and so the ethical starting points that I depend upon are informed by that set of beliefs about God and the world. And so in a Christian context, we recognize human beings are creatures of God among other creatures of God and confess a faith in a God who delights in the flourishing of all kinds of creatures, right from the beginning of the opening chapter of Genesis through Christian scriptures. We recognize that God is the God of all creatures, delights in their flourishing, wills their flourishing. And that means Christians who are seeking to respond to God's grace in creation and providence and redemption ought to be trying to attend to caring about fellow creatures in the way that God does. And so that is a very different starting point from the one that Peter's identified, but with substantial overlap, especially in the sense of a scandalous neglect in the way that we are treating animals for food.
Yes, right now there are 30 billion chickens alive on the planet, and almost all of them in factory farms. You are as one in your opposition to that. But this fascinating question of why, Peter, as he was explaining, it's about pain and a calculation of how much pain is experienced and how much suffering is there and how do we minimize that suffering. You paint a picture of animals that are made and loved and redeemed. This is an entirely different texture to your story, yeah?
It is. And I, that gives rise to a very interesting range of agreements and disagreements between Peter and myself about how we think about ethics, both in relation to animals and more generally. I don't know if Peter would agree, but one way of characterizing the difference between a utilitarian take on ethics and a traditional Christian take on ethics would be, I think, to say that utilitarianism sort of narrows down what is ethically relevant. So utilitarianism focuses on what it means to care about neighbors in Christian language, sort of identifies that as the most important or the only moral criterion, and then looks for ways to operationalize calculations about what maximizes neighbor well-being, whereas a traditional Christian ethic takes a much wider range of features of the world as morally relevant. For example, I think a norm against killing humans and other creatures is fundamental to a Christian way of doing things, not always one that can be treated as a moral absolute, but as a initial prima facie orientation to other beings in the world, not killing is a preferable thing to do. In the utilitarian framework, it's much harder to explain why killing might be a moral problem.
Well, I think it'd be wonderful to have each of you both as my next door neighbours, but let's go to the other side of the fence and ask Peter for your response.
To some extent, I agree with what David just said, that utilitarians focus on well-being, both suffering and happiness, rather than some of the other things that David talks about. But of course, that's partly because we have a different view of the universe. David refers to animals as God's creation. I, at least, don't believe that there is a divine creator and don't believe that there's a God who created animals. I believe, essentially, that we evolved from simpler life forms. And so some of the things that David might say, simply I couldn't say, because that would be postulating what I regard as fictitious entities who have done certain things or expressed certain wishes about how we should live, which obviously if they don't exist, that can't be the case. it's not just a pared down ethics that's ignoring other things. It's a pared down view of reality that I think divides us.
David, couldn't you convince more people if you brought all the Christians on board and people of other faiths and of no faith as well?
I'd be very happy to start with the 2 million Christians and then build out from there. But in the end, as I said at the beginning, I think we all need to be doing ethics from the starting points that we take. And what Peter's just said about sort of fundamental understandings of what it means to be creatures like us in the world is obviously going to inform the way we approach ethics as well as many other things. I would also say that I think the kind of Christian worldview that I'm describing might also capture sort of fundamental intuitions that we have about our ethical responsibilities towards other animals better than some competing ethical accounts. And so while I appreciate not everyone will share my initial presupposition, my initial article of faith that we live in a world wholly dependent upon God as creator. And by the way, I agree with Peter that we evolved from simpler organisms. Most Christians think that confessing God as creator and sustainer is compatible with a scientific account of evolutionary origins. But I think the idea, for example, that if we look at a chicken and understand carefully what a chicken needs to have a good life, and then move on from that judgment to say, well, if we know that's the way that chickens flourish, then subjecting chickens to the appalling conditions of a broiler warehouse where chickens are raised for meat and grown to slaughter weight in as little as 35 days, or keeping them in small cages to produce eggs and then slaughtered as soon as their productivity declines. If we have a basic idea of what it means for a chicken to flourish, to have a good life, then we can recognize the egregious wrong in raising chickens in conditions that don't allow that flourishing. And so while I agree there are some particular features like Christian starting point that won't be widely shared, I think that gut intuition of what it would mean to treat other creatures well and to care about their flourishing is a much more widely shared moral sensibility.
Yes, Peter, what do you think about this moral intuition, this thing that regardless of what your worldview is, there's a gut feeling that that is wrong to do that to an animal? And what happens when the intuition goes away, such as swatting an insect off your arm?
Right. Well, certainly, David and I completely agree on the wrongness of the way we're treating overwhelming majority of chickens on the planet today. There's no question about that. And when David uses the word flourishing, what does a chicken need to flourish? I think that is a good question to ask, because generally when a chicken is flourishing, then a chicken has their needs met. They presumably are capable of enjoying their lives, socializing with others of their species in a small group, as chickens have nature is to do. They're healthy. So, you know, we're giving them the conditions where they can absolutely minimize the amount of suffering and hopefully maximizing the amount of pleasure that they experience in their lives. And from my perspective, that's definitely a good thing. So I would use flourishing as a kind of indicator that in terms of well-being, these are how the chickens ought to live. I don't know whether David wants to say you something more about what it is to flourish. For example, that it is to bring out the nature of that particular creature as God intended or as God designed it. You know, if from a theistic point of view, if I held that view, I could certainly see that. And I must let me also say, I think it's really good, since there are, as David said, 2 billion Christians in the world. I think it's really good that Christians are now saying exactly what David is saying, because unfortunately for the majority of the long history of Christianity, they have not. They have ignored animal welfare. And so, you know, that's an important demographic, obviously, responsible for a lot of the cruelty that is going on, inflicted on animals in the world today. But it's significant that Christians do inflict this. If you look at where is the majority of the chicken production in the United States, it's in those southern states like Arkansas and Alabama and so on, where in fact the majority of people are Christians, and yet they still do this. So I hope that they will listen to David and they will realize that what they're doing is incompatible with being Christians and cease what they're doing.
David, there is this Christian idea of dominion over beasts, that we are in the image of God and animals have no souls. Do you see yourself as fighting tradition or recovering it, reclaiming it?
I think we need to be attentive to complexity and variation and nuance when we're talking about the history of Christian engagement with animals and with the current ways in which Christians interpret their faith. And so from my review of the history of the Christian tradition, there have been substantial high points in relation to recognizing what it means to live in this astonishing world of God's sort of wonderful creatures and to be attending well to them. And a lot of the early 19th century developments in relation to laws against cruelty to animals and campaigns for better treatment of animals are rooted in a Christian and Jewish recognition. This is in Global North in the UK and in the United States, recognizing that because we know that God cares about creatures, then we should care about fellow creatures as well. And so there's a very honorable tradition of Christians recognizing, because they believe the kinds of things they do about God and the world, that means that cruelty to animals is unacceptable. But I absolutely recognize with Peter that there are versions of the Christian narrative that have been operative in the past and are operative now, which tell Christians that they have divine license to exploit fellow creatures for their own ends without regard for their flourishing, and that's a big problem. And so if we take a verse out of the first chapter of Genesis where God says, let human beings have dominion over the other animals, take that out of context and say, well, that means God says we can do what we like, that's a huge problem. It's a very convenient belief to think that God tells you you can do what you want for your own selfish ends. I think as soon as we begin to attend to what it means to read the Bible well, we very quickly realize that that is not an appropriate interpretation of the text. At the end of Genesis 1, God prescribes a vegan diet for human beings, and that's a surprise to most Christians that want to grab that dominion text and not read a couple of verses on to say when ancient Israel was thinking about what it would mean for God's will to be fully and completely reflected in the world, that would mean that no creature was consuming another creature for food. Everyone's a vegan at the end of Genesis 1, and it's only later God gives permission for meat eating. And so I think we need to reclaim an understanding of what dominion and image of God means. And for me, that means recognizing if human beings are going to image God in the way they live in the world, that means imaging the God that Christians worship, a God who is gracious to creatures, a God who brings creatures into flourishing with love and delight, and who wants creatures to thrive. And so if we're going to image that kind of God, that means a radical attentiveness to what it would mean for other creatures to flourish. If instead we think that industrialized animal agriculture images a divinity, that seems to me you'd be imaging a tyrant, you'd be imaging a devil, thinking that everything is exploitable for one's own ends. And so everything for me is about good reading, good interpretation, good understanding of a Christian faith tradition. And for me, that has radical implications that suggest that major features of how we're treating other animals are egregiously at odds with what Christians confess about God and the world.
On ABC Radio National, you are listening to God Forbid, in particular David Clough, who's Professor of Theology at the University of Aberdeen, his two-volume epic On Animals, a masterpiece of Christian animal theology. We are also with Professor Peter Singer, Emeritus Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. His podcast, Lives Well Lived, I should say his work, Animal Liberation, 50 years ago, is now re-released as Animal Liberation Now, that book so instrumental in the growth of the modern animal liberation movement. Peter Singer, you and David agree, and you've mentioned that the chicken should flourish. He says as God intended, you say as nature intended. But didn't God and nature both also intend for that chicken to be, you know, torn to shreds by a fox as well?
I have to correct you, James. I did not say as nature intended. I don't believe nature has any intentions. Nature is a blind process. Chickens evolve in a certain way because their ancestors survived. They were free-living jungle fowls around Burma, and then they were domesticated, and then the modern chicken was specifically bred, as David mentioned, to put on weight. It's incredibly fast, so that essentially people are eating, you know, 5 or 6 week old babies, and they're just as fat as or bigger than adult chickens used to be. So there's neither nature nor God in the way chickens are today, I believe. My view is simply that they are capable of suffering. They are conscious beings. They are not just things. And given that, and given that suffering, we recognize suffering is a bad thing. We certainly recognize that in our own case. And I believe we ought to recognize it in the case of others as well. That's part of what it is to think ethically, that when we recognize things as bad, we don't think of them as just bad for us, but as bad for any being experiencing that. So that's why I think chickens should be allowed to flourish so that they don't experience the suffering that they otherwise will. And hopefully they experience some pleasure, positive feelings in their life. But I'm certainly not one who thinks that the way nature does things is the right way. And, you know, if you mention foxes and other predators, well, I mean, I think it's an interesting question for David, really, why a divine being would have created a world in which there is so much killing goes on, in which there are species of animals, quite numerous ones, that can only survive by killing other animals and that do so in ways that inflict suffering. I think if there were a divine being who was also omnibenevolent and good, then there would have been a better design for the world where that killing wasn't occurring. But unfortunately, the world we live in just isn't that. So the best we can do is to try to minimize suffering, and we can start with the suffering that we're inflicting on all those non-human animals on a absolutely vast scale, a barely comprehensible scale. You said something, James, about 30 billion chickens living in factory farms, but there are vast numbers of other animals, including fish. We factory farm fish too. And best estimate I've seen is that something like 200 billion animals are raised and killed in factory farms worldwide each year. So, you know, that dwarfs not only the present human population, but it's larger than the number of all humans who have ever existed, and we're inflicting miserable lives on them.
David?
I think it's interesting to note that both Peter's approach to ethics and mine looks at things as they are and finds reasons to think that they should be otherwise, that we have moral reasons to recognize that things are not okay between us and other animals and to make changes in how we live as a result. So I think that's an interesting point of congruence. And I recognize that in a Christian view, this existence of suffering in the world has, you know, long been recognized as a tension if Christians confess a God who is both the origin of all that is and powerful in relation to all that is. There's this fundamental question of the problem of evil. If that's the case, why are things not optimal? And we could spend a long time on the problem of evil and different theistic explanations for that. To be honest, as a Christian ethicist, I don't spend very much time at all thinking about the problem of evil, except in its practical ramifications. From my point of view as a Christian ethicist, Christians need to recognize that they find themselves in a world in which suffering exists, and also they confess faith in a God whose will is for this suffering not to be the case. And so in terms of ethics, that generates a clear sense of moral responsibility, not that we have the power to, you know, change everything that is. And Christians sort of talk about eschatology and a hope in a future time when things will be different. St. Paul in Romans 8 talks about looking forward to a time when creation will go through its labor pains, it's sort of the sort of pain of the current time, and look forward to a time when the whole of creation will be liberated from bondage. And so a Christian view is to recognize that we are not there yet, that we live at the moment in a world in which creation is groaning and creatures like us and unlike us are suffering, but to be doing what we can to be responding to the needs of fellow creatures, human and more than human, to be promoting their flourishing and alleviating their suffering. And so Peter and I can have a long conversation about whose account of the world and God, or the lack of a God, makes most overall sense, but share some sense of what it would mean to engage with the plight of fellow creatures here and now.
You do share the engagement on the concern and of the suffering of animals. Let's turn to what it means practically and what its implications are for doing better. We are with Peter Singer, Emeritus Professor of Bioethics at Princeton, and David Clough, Professor of Theology and Applied Sciences at the University of Aberdeen. Peter Singer, let's look at this question of not factory farming, but what they call high welfare farming, free range, organic, a place where chickens can flourish before they're ultimately killed to be eaten by humans. Does this solve the problem or just make us feel better about it?
Well, it doesn't completely solve the problem. It may make us feel better about it, but it doesn't merely do that, because it does give animals better lives. And for me, the question to ask about that is, where should we, that is people who are concerned about the suffering of animals, focus our energies at present? And, you know, I've thought slightly differently about this maybe over my career. Maybe I spoke more generally when I was younger about the need to stop the commercial exploitation of animals altogether, because that really is the root of the problem, in a sense. And if you really wanted to take a clean ethical line, then you wouldn't eat the flesh or eggs or milk of animals who had been commercially raised but had had better lives because they were not in factory farms. But, you know, perhaps it's because it's more than 50 years since I wrote Animal Liberation, and unfortunately, factory farming has not gone away in that period. On the contrary, it's actually, there are more animals in factory farms now than there were at any time previously. So I'm now more concerned to oppose that. And so if there are people who say to me, look, I totally agree with you about factory farms, it's just wrong to be complicit in that by consuming and buying the products of factory farms, but you know, I really wouldn't like to go without certain animal products, and so I'm going to look around for bona fide, ethically produced animal products. And you can find them; depends a bit on the country, but you know, so you can find them in many countries where animals have had good lives and where the people running them have had some concern for the welfare of their lives. But in the end, they've certainly killed them when they needed to do that for the commercial viability of their enterprise. I'm going to say, I'm not, you know, if you're against factory farms, that's the main point for me now. Join me in opposing factory farming. If that means you get more customers for your high welfare animal products, so be it. But if we can just cut into the much greater amount of suffering, greater both on scale and in intensity, that is experienced by the animals in factory farms, that's where the action is at the moment. That's the real struggle we need to be engaged in.
David, do you agree?
I do. I'm vegan. I think in the end, if we have a choice between making our living, finding things to feed our bodies that depend on the suffering and death of fellow creatures, or alternatively finding ways to live healthy and flourishing lives that don't depend on that suffering and death, then I think Christians and others have good reason to prefer a plant-based diet. But I agree with Peter that the moral priority is to recognize the scandalous wrongdoing of raising fellow creatures in factory conditions and look for an initial commitment. Can we at least agree that that is egregiously at odds with anything that we consider properly ethical? While that sounds like a moderate position in relation to advocacy for global veganism now, it actually is astonishingly radical in relation to the change that it requires. So probably 95%+ of all animal products produced on the planet at the moment are coming from industrialized animal agriculture. If we're serious about stopping our complicity with that egregiously wrong practice, that basically means a massive drop in consumption and then production of animal products. Only a few percent of global animal production is permissible if we agree that industrialized animal agriculture is egregiously wrong. And so then if we want to take the next practical step, we need to find strategies quickly to reduce consumption of animal products. And so then I'm really interested in new strategies that are becoming increasingly mainstream that are achieving big reductions. And the one I'm most excited about is the adoption of plant-based defaults in catering. And so in institutional contexts, making plant-based products the default, allowing people to choose to consume animal products instead. But that's been demonstrated in interesting mainstream studies on university campuses and in hospitals, and to be a really effective way of achieving significant reductions at pace without provoking big defensive reactions.
Well, what about, David, lab-grown meat, actual meat? I mean, it's in its infancy, but actual animal meat that just has been grown in a petri dish, not in a factory farm.
So I think that avoids almost all of the moral problems that Peter and I are discussing in relation to treatment of animals. And as a path to a future in which we are achieving this massive reduction in consumption of animal products, I think we need as many promising strategies as possible.
And Peter Singer, do you think lab-grown meat is ethical? And if so, are you prepared to eat it?
Not only am I prepared to eat it, I have eaten it. I've eaten lab-grown meat on two occasions. Firstly, lab-grown chicken in Singapore, which was the first country to allow... See, this word lab-grown, we should not be talking about. We're not talking about really laboratories. This is produced in factories like a lot of other food is, I guess, bioreactors. So Singapore was the first place to allow the sale of, let's call it cultivated chicken. I sampled it at a place. It seemed to me not particularly tasty and nothing that I wish to put back in my diet, being more than 50 years since I'd eaten chicken from animals. And then more recently here in Melbourne, I was invited to visit a research unit that was producing cellular minced lamb. So I ate a meatball that had been grown from a cell taken from an animal, but without harming the animal. And that was much better, I have to say. It sort of was juicy and tasty, and I would welcome it coming on the market. I wouldn't feel any great need to eat it myself. But as David was saying, if that's what it will take to get other people to move away from meat from animals and particularly from factory farms, then I certainly welcome it. I hope it comes on the market very soon, and I hope it comes on the market at a competitive price, because that is one of the problems, clearly, even with some of the plant-based meat-like analogues. They're more expensive than meat from animals. So I'm hopeful that eventually this will cease to be the case, that it will be just as tasty or tastier. It may be even healthier because it can be designed in terms of the balance of nutrients. And as well as reducing the animal suffering, I think we should mention, it will be much better on the environment. Greenhouse gases, pollution in various forms. We will really be much better off if these products do arrive and if the public turns away from factory farming.
Peter, you mentioned the health of the environment. What about the animals that are so damaging to the Australian environment? Feral animals, cats, deer, rabbits, brumbies. How do you see, you know, questions of culling them to protect and save Indigenous flora and fauna?
This is a serious ethical problem, and it's one in which there are conflicting values at stake and no easy solution, because unfortunately Europeans have brought these animals to Australia. They compete, and in many cases outcompete the native species of animals we had here. And they change the environment in a whole range of ways. And I think we can all value biodiversity for different reasons. Some people will say it's an intrinsic value. I might say it's a value that leads to more sustainability, that it leads to greater enjoyment of different environments. But I recognize that there are values here. At the same time, if we are culling and getting rid of the descendants of these feral animals that Europeans wrongly brought here, I think we have a requirement to do it as humanely as we possibly can. It's not their fault that they're here. They are still sentient beings. We owe them the respect for their suffering, concern for their suffering, and we need to find the best possible ways of allowing Australia's native fauna and also flora to flourish, but that can't just be done willy-nilly, independently of how much suffering it causes the animals.
And your view on this, David?
I agree that this is a morally complex topic. So in Christian theological language, I would talk about the fallenness of creation, this sense that things as we see them seem to be sort of at odds with a Christian vision of peaceable coexistence between creatures that God wills. And so in the midst of things, we find ourselves confronted with all kinds of boundary problems where the flourishing of all creatures is not possible here and now. And so we need to find ways to, I think, live as peaceably as we can among other creatures and be trying to discern what is the sort of best mode of enabling the flourishing of the creatures we find ourselves among. And so when we're confronted with this kind of question of anthropogenic problem, where humans have created a conflict between creatures, we need to be sort of reflecting wisely on how to resolve it. I was particularly struck when I visited New Zealand. There seems to be a very simplistic moral enthusiasm for the extermination of mammals, who are the sort of non-indigenous creatures. And I recognize the large-scale motivation for that in terms of protecting indigenous wildlife. But I was quite struck by some sort of radical alternatives. I understand that some Maori leaders are trying to find places for particular species of rats to be able to flourish in ways that don't threaten indigenous wildlife. And I would hope that we could continue to look for more peaceable ways of resolving these kinds of interspecies conflicts rather than the kinds of strategies that are much more violent and cause a lot of suffering to the animals we've decided are in the wrong place. We need to be thinking across the human-non-human boundary in terms of how we live well.
But what happens, David, when we have to make the decision that humans matter more than animals, that we want doctors to do experiments on rats to make them better doctors rather than to do experiments on humans to make them better veterinarians?
I think, again, we are faced with a morally complex situation. I think we do have reasons to, in sort of boundary conflict situations, we have reasons to prefer caring for human neighbors rather than non-human neighbors, where it's a zero-sum game between their interests. But I think we massively exaggerate that sort of zero-sum argument, the idea that human flourishing can only be pursued at the cost of non-human exploitation. And animal experimentation is a particular case in point. So I think most of the experimentation we are currently doing on other animals in the UK, which is thought to be one of the most highly regulated experimental environments, and globally, almost everything that we're doing treats other animals as morally negligible. We basically are pursuing research agendas as if the interests of these other animals mattered not at all. And I think if we took a step back and objectively thought about how to deploy research resources in a way that would appropriately reflect a pursuit for human and more than human flourishing, most of what we're currently doing in relation to experimentation on other animals would be illegitimate. I've spent a lot of time visiting animal research labs, and I'm very struck by the particular institutional structures where particular professors have developed a particular career, training PhD students in particular methodologies. And so there's a lot of conservatism within that experimentation practice that resists the idea that there would be other ways to pursue the knowledge that we need in order to improve human flourishing.
What's a utilitarian view on this, Peter Singer?
I think a utilitarian view on this is not that different. I'm not going to say that no experiment on animals can ever be justified, irrespective of the benefit for humans. But I am going to say, as David just did, that the interests of the non-human animals must be given full consideration. They must not be discounted just because they're not members of our species. And I totally agree with David that in most institutions that do animal experimentation, they are treated basically as living tools for research. And these institutions become very conservative because the professors who've built a career doing this don't know really anything else to do. And so they train their students to do the same kind of thing. And I think also there's now good evidence that a lot of this money that we're spending on animal research is not being well used, even if you did ignore, which you shouldn't, the suffering of the animals, because so much of it is just not translatable to humans. And we see this over and over again, that something that is developed that is shown to cure cancer in mice, let's say, then when it's actually tested on humans, fails. And the United States relatively recently has started to recognize this and has announced various policies to transition away from animal experiments, maybe not 100%. For example, the National Institutes of Health, the biggest government grant-giving body, has said that it will no longer accept research grant applications which are only focused on animal experiments. They will have to look at other ways of obtaining knowledge as well. That sort of shift has been a long time coming. Certainly the documents and statements that have been put out in the last year or two by the National Institutes of Health and other US government bodies have been positive in terms of talking about moving away from animals. I hope that they actually carry this out, that it becomes more than just words on paper, and that we find better ways of replacing the animal experiments with non-animal methods of finding out the same thing, which, as I say, can be more cost-effective, can be more closely related to the results we want, that is, results on humans. And I hope that this long-awaited shift is now at last starting to develop some momentum.
Well, on ABC Radio National, you are listening to David Clough, who's Professor of Theology at the University of Aberdeen, his two-volume epic on animals. We are also with Professor Peter Singer, his podcast, Lives Well Lived. His work, Animal Liberation, 50 years ago, is now re-released as Animal Liberation Now, that book so instrumental in the growth of the modern animal liberation movement. This is God Forbid. I'm James Carlton. We are with Peter Singer. We are with David Clough. We acknowledge that many people, most people indeed, believe cruelty to animals is wrong. We've been exploring all hour this question of why. David, I want to ask you, I mean, Peter says that animals suffer, and that's why it's important. We need to minimize that suffering to the extent that we can. You say animals in the Christian context, they are created and loved and redeemed, and this is why they matter. What about if both those arguments somewhat miss the point in that humans and animals are relational? So it's not a question of the mathematics of how much suffering is there. It's not a question of a creator God, but a question of relations that animals have with other animals, the relations that animals have with humans. Why is it that we profoundly grieve the death of our dog, whereas a pig has just as much capacity to suffer, and we will eat that animal?
Yeah, I think thinking about relationality is another really promising way of doing better and thinking better in relation to fellow creatures. And so I really warm to that comparison that you make, and I would see that as a moral resource. Many of us have non-human animals that we share our homes with, and we recognize them as members of our family. As you say, we grieve their loss significantly. We had a cat, Mitzi, who lived with us for 18 years until last summer, when her health problems became too difficult to manage. And I recognize that I grieve her loss more than I would some of the human neighbors on my street who I know less well and spend less time with. And so we have that readily available experience of recognizing what it means to be in good relationship with fellow creatures. And then I think, as you say, we need the moral imagination to recognize that the animals that are similar to the ones that we love and care about and grieve have as much claim on our moral attention as companions and pets. And so if we can begin to stretch our moral imagination to recognize that the pigs that we consume for food are also in relationship to us, and that choosing to purchase pork or chicken or beef or fish has impacts on the life of all these kinds of fellow creatures. If we can begin to stretch our moral imagination to recognize that that represents a wrong to a creature similar in significant respects to cats or dogs or other animals we share our homes with, I think that can be a beginning of a sort of moral transformation. To recognize, if I wouldn't be happy with someone doing that to my dog or my cat, I shouldn't be happy participating in a system where a chicken or a pig or a cow or a sheep is treated in that kind of way.
And Peter, I must ask, have there been animals in your life that you've loved and lost? And has that invited you to re-question the mathematics, the cold mathematics of calculating suffering that utilitarianism invites?
Well, I don't agree that utilitarians are coldly calculating suffering. They are doing calculations, but they are concerned about suffering, and that can be an emotional response to suffering. But to answer your specific question, well, when I grew up, we had a cat in the home. When we had small children, they were very keen to have companion animals. We actually had some ex-laboratory rats who were very affectionate little companions we had. They could sit on your lap, and then they would climb up through your jumper and emerge through the neck of the jumper and sit on your shoulder. We enjoyed having them around. And we had a cat as well, because we had a friend who was like a magnet for stray cats. And once she got up to seven, she said to us, "Would you perhaps like one of these cats?" And of course, my children said, "Oh, yes, please, Mummy, please, Daddy, can we have the cats?" So we've had them. But I don't have any companion animals now. I don't particularly want to have a companion animal. But I would like to come to something that David just said, because what he was really saying was not just about, you started out saying something like, well, relationship with animals, is that important? And David took up that, started with that, but then went from the relationship that he had with the cat Mitzi, he mentioned, to the ability to think about other animals who all you see of them, the only relationship you have is that their corpses are for sale in the supermarket, and to think about them as individuals. And that's a kind of an interesting exercise, I think, that I do value, but it's not really placing intrinsic value on the relationship. It's rather saying, let the relationship with an animal and your firsthand knowledge of what a non-human animal might be extend to the other animals who also were individuals, who also had lives of their own to lead, who also had individual personalities, but were not treated as your companion animal was, because they were just an object of commerce. They were a commodity to some enormous agribusiness producing them as a product. And, we've been talking about the Christian perspective that's David's. I'm not myself a Buddhist, but I had an interesting dialogue with a monastic in Taiwan called Shi Chao Wei, which we ended up publishing as a book called The Buddhist and the Ethicist. And she talked about compassion, but she drew a distinction between kind of emotional, purely emotional compassion, which you will feel, of course, much more strongly for the individual animal you know, or the individual child you know and love, and what she called rational compassion, which in the Buddhist tradition is something that may emerge from meditation, from contemplating what it would be like if something terrible were to be done to somebody you loved, and then extending that to somebody who is not somebody you love, but maybe somebody you're acquainted with, and then extending that to somebody who you're not acquainted with, but whom you can know things about their lives, and in this way, developing that capacity. And nobody would say that that's a cold, calculating practice, but I think that is, to some extent, what utilitarians are doing. We're just saying, we know, we understand that all these beings are capable of suffering. We are opposed to suffering. We would feel very emotional about somebody inflicting that suffering on someone we loved and cared for, especially if we could see it happening. But we ought then to think similarly about the suffering of the animals where we can't see it and we don't know them. And we have the opportunity to either be complicit in it, in that sense, endorse it by buying the products, or to say, no, that's wrong and I'm not going to be part of it.
I'm certainly not cold when you put it that way. Just a final question to wrap up what's been a most informative hour. Looking to the future, David Clough, in a couple of generations, in half a century from now, you know, how will we look back on factory farming? You know, inefficient because we will have much more efficient industrial factory farming, or will we be in some other direction altogether?
I don't think, as an ethicist, I'm in the profession of futurology. And so what I would want to emphasize is that future is open, and we could see paths in which Christians and others get more selfish and less concerned for their human and non-human neighbors. And that looks like a scenario in which human and more than human flourishing gets much worse. So I think we need to take really seriously the possibility of that kind of scenario. And then there's another possible future where we begin to recognize that the patterns of our living need really significant change if we're going to work out what it would mean for all of us to flourish as well as we may. And so I would encourage everyone to be thinking of that as an open future. I'm not by nature an optimist, but I'm absolutely passionate about working to our utmost to do what's within our power to be contributing towards the increased possibility of a future where humans and other creatures have greater opportunities for flourishing. And I think that's the moral project.
Peter, David, not by nature an optimist, but very morally ambitious. Future, where do you see it?
Well, David's absolutely right that having studied ethics does not equip you to predict the future, if anybody indeed can predict the future. Most futurologists get a lot wrong. Still, I will say something, and that is that I do think that future generations will not be factory farming anymore, whether that's because they've developed morally or because they've got better technologies for producing their food. But I think they will look back on factory farming with the same horror that we Australians anyway, look back to what early European settlers in Australia did to the indigenous people of this country. And Americans might look back to the acceptance of slavery in a substantial part of the United States, you know, and they will wonder how their ancestors could really have done these things to animals, how they could have been so blind to the suffering of animals and so callous and selfish to be prepared to inflict so much suffering on such a vast number of animals merely because they liked the taste of a particular product rather than of the plant-based alternatives to it.
And on that note, we have reached the end of God Forbid. Thank you so much, Peter Singer, for being on the show again.
Thank you very much, James.
And Peter is Emeritus Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. His podcast, Lives Well Lived. We'll put a link to Lives Well Lived on the God Forbid website. And David Clough, thank you from Aberdeen for being on the show as well.
It's been a pleasure to be in conversation. Thanks for the time.
And David is Professor of Theology and Applied Sciences at the University of Aberdeen, author of On Animals, the two-volume theological epic. There's a more accessible work, Christian Ethics of Farmed Animal Welfare. We'll put a link to a free copy of that on the God Forbid website. That's where you can find, follow and share the program, and email me as well at godforbid@abc.net.au. A big thanks to producer Amanda Roberts, technical production from Roy Huberman. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, do remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.